I bought a heater before Christmas to take the chill out of the air in my writing studio. A dainty little fan heater in pearl white plastic. It hummed softly in the corner and I could feel warm air moving around the room. That was the last thing I did before diving into the glittering mirage of jingling bells on Christmas Eve, and I didn't open my studio door again until the festival was finished. My wife spoke early on Boxing Day, and her first words were, "Thank God it's over." We say that every year, but the fuss and anxiety never changes. It comes, and then it goes, and we wake up the morning afterwards with a kind of relief. The in-between days, just after Boxing Day and before the New Year, are empty. Even the sky is painted in watercolours, and I spend hours staring at sad flickering lights in the garden and wonder not just where Christmas has gone, but where my entire life went. Myself and my wife break the shells of our eggs in unison. We enjoy the physical harmony of animals who have spent a lifetime together. "Where does it go?" I ask her sometimes. But she doesn't reply. Instead, she just offers me another slice of toast. Over the years, Christmas rituals have woven our separate lives into a single fabric. We have observed the same tedious rituals year after year. We have shared Christmas turkeys with Granny and other loved ones long gone to their eternal rest. We've shared plum puddings with couples who are now divorced, and we pulled dozens of crackers with our children before they grew up and went off to feed their own horses somewhere else. The cyclic nature of Christmas is reassuring. The repetition of things is comforting. To know that life is a wheel of beginnings and endings, and that we return to the same old beginning each January. Christmas vanishes like smoke from a quenched candle, like snow from a rope, and the empty January sky becomes a refuge as the light stretches ever so delicately towards the shoots of a crocus in the grass beneath the beeches. I sit by the window as the afternoon fills up with sleeping cats, and I sense in the renewal of sunlight that I am forgiven once more and free to begin again. I realise that soon the sun will rise higher and the spring will arrive without my efforts or anxieties. In short, I have nothing to worry about. One Christmas when I was 10 years old, I worried a lot because I broke the Virgin Mary statue by letting her fall on the mosaic floor of the cathedral, and I was carrying her enormous plaster weight to the crib where she was supposed to hang out for the festival. She skittered along the marble for 3 long metres. Her hands were scratched, and I worried that the priest would wallop me across the same marble floor for being so careless. But no one except me noticed the damaged fingers of the Holy Virgin as she knelt in frozen prayer for the entire 12 days of Christmas, gazing in porcelain equanimity at her equally porcelain baby in the manger. I endured that Christmas season in terror, because back then the crib meant a lot to me, and to desecrate it was like undoing the universe. But then I grew up, and like many more in Ireland, I abandoned the infant and the angels and saw the dead plaster statues for what they really were. We still put up a crib on the mantelpiece, but when people come to call, they rarely notice it except to wonder why it's there. Nowadays, the season is bloated with realism, opulence, and digestible delights. I must wait until January to find poetry, because in January the earth turns again, turns around, and it shifts the heft of its hope towards the sun. And the sky is so empty and watery that almost everything feels possible again. When I returned to work, my studio was like an icebox. I was glad I had bought the heater before the holiday to take the chill out of the air, the dainty little fan heater in pearl white plastic. It hummed softly in the corner, and I could feel warm air moving around the room. I pressed the power button on the computer and waited for the screen to light up. And as the dainty white fan heater in the corner pushed air around the room, I noticed the lace curtains moving. And for no reason in particular, it reminded me of an angel's feather. Just after the angel has gone. And that's where I think we are. I think we're in this space. And I've agonized about this. I've agonized about it for a couple of years. And I still agonize about it. And it's the question, what do I do with my faith? And when I have faith, how do I express it? And really, is my faith worth it? And it's challenging for everybody, because we have only two possible ways to live. You can live in the realism of the world around you, where your body is inundated with information, your physical body and your mind, your consciousness, and it's just taken over by whatever happens at a physical level. And the other way is where you try and impose on it, or you try to discover within it a kind of a platonic model. I know that sounds a little bit heavy, but it's just that Plato had this idea that everything we experience is coming from an ideal form of that thing. Do you know that if you saw a table, there is a kind of a form of tableness, a conceptual table that is inside the table, embodied in the table, and that you can only recognize it as a table because you already have that form within you. And somebody once said that, you know, European history is merely footnotes to Plato. And you could say that European philosophy is just footnotes to Plato, because that sense of a dualism whereby there are forms, and the forms give meaning to our sensate experience, that's still with us. The way of perception that Plato was putting his finger on hasn't changed much. And the two extremes of it would be, on the one hand, where you just kind of go in the river as a meaningless life and try and enjoy all the sensation and pleasure you can. And that would be extreme. And the other extreme would be where you kind of live in an imaginal realm. You live in a kind of a realm of ideas, where you moralize reality out of existence, because your head is just full of, like, what's the right thing and the proper thing to do, and then you do nothing. And I think that human life is this constant struggle between what's on the surface, what is sensate, what is just bombarding us by the fact that we are passing through time and space. You see, a lot of this is to do with being trapped in time and space, really. Our conscious mind is only conscious in its particularity, you know. We become aware of the candle, we become aware of our lover, we become aware of the dog we're walking with or the wind on our face. We become aware of our anger or jealousy, our rage, or our desires for people or things. So our consciousness is always trapped in time and space. And yet there's something about it. We always have this sense that, well, when thoughts are flowing through our mind, that if only we could stop the thoughts, there would be a self, there would be a sense of consciousness that would be still and would recognize everything being out there as similar to what one is oneself, that you belong in the universe, and that your consciousness would then be just a glowing moment of compassion for eternity. There's a great line in the Buddhist texts that says, emptiness is the mother of compassion. What they mean is that in Buddhist thought, dependent arising, we might call it contingency, you know, that nothing exists of itself. The table doesn't exist of itself. It was made, it has a function, it only has meaning insofar as we impose some meaning on it and say we will use this as a table. Might be the back of a door. It might be the back of a door that we put cement blocks under outside in the garden for a barbecue. Then it becomes the table. And there is nothing, not even our own self, that exists like totally separate from the interaction with everything else in time and space. And in Buddhist thought, this is fierce important. It's like the dependent emptiness, shunyata, they'd say. Shunyata is not like an absolute emptiness, because emptiness is saying there's no absolutes. Emptiness is saying that nothing exists from its own side, in itself, sui generis. Nothing is just there as itself. It's always dependent on something else. Even you're dependent on oxygen. Everything is interrelated. There's nothing just existing separately in an absolute sense. And so emptiness is not in an absolute either. Emptiness is the lack of that containment that would give something absolute presence. Emptiness is like everything karmically depends on everything else. There's a chain reaction in the entire cosmos. In the entire cosmos, both spatially and time-wise, everything is just a little link in the chain of reality. Quantum physicists would tell you the same thing. And so if there's nothing kind of that exists in itself, if everything is in that sense empty, and if I see myself as empty, there's no reason for me to feel different from you. Just think about that for a minute. I know you're there, and you're present to me. I'm not talking to a God. I'm not talking to something that's absolute, that exists in itself. I know that you are there, but that you too are contingent on your birth, on your mother, on those who feed you and love you, those who sustain you emotionally, and the water you drink and the air you breathe and the food. and the food that comes from somewhere else, like the earth, and the earth that is watered by the skies and the rain. Everything about you is just a moment where all this interconnectedness assumes selfhood, but doesn't have any kind of independent self. And that's true for you, but it's also true for me here. And that makes me and you, like, not just similar, like not just like two stones are similar, but it means that we're linked. We're both dependent within the same system of contingency. We're both leaning on each other, even though we may not see it. It may not be at the surface. I may not know your name. You may live in a different country or continent, but you and I are one. Your struggle, I can feel now your joy. I can feel your laughter. I can feel your sorrow. Because it's not like your sorrow and my sorrow are separate things. No, it's the same noise. It's the same music that comes from both of us, because both of us are the one thing, because we are dependent. We're not independent. We are contingent. And this contingency ends in death. Your annihilation and my annihilation. And all you have at that moment is the good deeds that have shaped your intentionality, the good deeds that I have shaped, my karma, following me like a shadow, can never get away from it. So you see the way that line they have in one of the Buddhist texts, that, you know, emptiness, that's emptiness. That's emptiness. Emptiness, they say, is the mother of compassion. And we get locked up in a sense of, you know, I'm right and you're wrong. And there's an awful lot of it at the moment in relation to various wars and big wars. Wars that are going on and are huge in the Yemen and in Sudan and other places in the world that we don't really notice because for some reason they're not on our radar. But the ones that are on our radar, one close is Ukraine and close enough is Gaza. And Gaza means the Middle East. Gaza means that whole region. So there's two huge regions, like Europe, Russia being one conflict, and the West and Middle Eastern Islam being another. They're kind of very hot tinderboxes of rage and anger. And when you look on TikTok and you look on YouTube, when you listen to the news, there's so many people with an anger, a rage, and they would say absolutely a justified rage, born out of the conviction, like there's rage in people who are suffering in war, and that's coming. That's the valid truth of anger. It's like God's righteousness. This should not be happening. These bombs should not be dismembering my children. That's a rage against evil. But when you come further back from it, you can get a rage that people have, which is not coming from the experience of that, but from the sense that who's right and who's wrong. And you get it on both sides. It's a huge anger starts to... And on both sides, they will say, well, it's righteous anger. On both sides. And to be honest, I feel like everybody else, I wonder about it. I wonder about the war in Gaza, the terrible atrocities of Gaza, the terrible war in Ukraine. And I wonder, and I think, like, what should I say? I don't mean like here. I wouldn't be saying anything here. I'm not saying anything. I don't do politics. But what should I say to myself in the mirror in my own heart when I wake up in the morning and I want a happy day? And I know there are people in the world who are having this appalling suffering. And I think it's very easy to become involved on one side or the other. And I think what's harder is to constantly make a space for non-violence in yourself. I don't mean that you're lecturing other people on non-violence. I give you an example of it. Like this happens to me. I wake, let's say, at 7 o'clock in the morning and I listen to the news. And the news is so terrible that by the time I'm brushing my teeth, I'm raging. And it's amazing how quickly a pattern of my prejudices will fall into place. It only one little news item and I can have a full view of either Putin or Zelensky or Netanyahu or Hamas. Within a few seconds, I have the whole thing sorted as who's the bad one. And it's frightening how quick it happens. And by the time I'm putting the yogurt on my porridge, I'm kind of annoyed. I'm using dental aggression on the porridge. I'm chewing it like I'd nearly chew me tongue off. And I know that that's no good for me. I know it's no good to be angry. I know that what's needed is this sense of, what I say, creating a space of non-violence. And the best example then I can use for that is not the big issues, because I'm not at this moment involved in the war, in either of those wars. I remember one time I was living in Fermanagh, and to some extent I was in the middle of a war. I was having sensate experiences and social interaction that were war-like things happening, so you couldn't avoid how you felt. There was war going on all around me, and the danger was I would become radicalized on one side or the other. And what was really a lesson for me in those situations was that you lose your own balance if you go there. If you commit, when you see the righteous, when you see the ones who you perceive as being absolutely right in their position in a war, whether they're victims or oppressors, if you side with them, you lose your balance. You become, no matter that you're thousands of miles away from the war zone, you become infused with rage as if you were on the very barricades. And it's very hard not to feel, well, that's a good thing, because you're coming, you're giving moral support to the victims. I'm not convinced about that, because you may be only putting coal on the fire. You may be only heating the thing further. And if things have got into a kind of a radical conflict, even socially, and two guys in a outside a bar are about to fight each other physically, and you start to really support one side or the other, you may be adding fuel. You may be encouraging the intensity that will allow the two guys to tear each other apart. And I know this is very difficult. I mean, that's why I struggle with it, and that's why I'm sharing it with you. I never share anything that I feel is the truth, like this is the truth I'm telling you. I don't do that. This podcast is about how little I know. This podcast is about me, in some sense, sharing or confessing with you how little I know. And my sense is that in all those situations, politically, if you can keep your balance and see both sides and listen to both sides and study and examine the history and the narrative of both sides, it leaves you in a better position to be helpful to both sides. But it also leaves you in a position that you're not losing your own balance. You're not being infected by their anger. And that's certainly one thing I saw when I lived in Fermanagh during the Troubles. When you were able to keep your balance, that was a powerful lesson. And I'll tell you another place where it happens, and that's in relationships. You know when you're, I mean, my family, I'm blessed. So it's never happened in my family, but it happens in loads of other places where I'd be working with somebody. And you're intensely close to somebody when you're working with them, especially in the arts. And then something happens and I feel they've done something wrong on me, let's say. They've cheated me in some way. They've been dishonest in some way. Or they've slandered me. They've said something about me to somebody, you know, which is not true. And you can feel very, very angry. You know, because you always see yourself as, what Robert Thurman says, you always see yourself as the one. I'm the one. Like, I'm the one who's important. You're not. I'm the one who's important. I've been offended. You know the way you get white rage when somebody slanders you? And you're like, you're there saying, I'm the one who has been slandered. I'm the one, you know, it's like me. And so it's like the sense of being offended, in a strange way, it reinforces your absolute sense of yourself. Like, me. Me. You insulted me? It's like, me? And that's a tricky one to let go of. Robert Thurman now is brilliant on that conversation. But it's a tricky one. The non-existence of self in Buddhist terms would demand that you sort of relax there a bit, baby, you know. You're being slandered, so what? It's not like the end of the world, right? It's okay. But it is tricky. And I found it many times in my life tricky. I found it many times I lost my balance, and I used the phrase, don't lose your balance, because it was Tom McIntyre said it to me on a particular day. I remember it well. We were going to, my God, he was a great actor, and we went to his funeral, and I can't remember his name. It'll come to me in a second. But just a wonderful actor. Donal, what's his second name? My God, I can't remember it. It's on the tip of my tongue. But anyway, we're going to this funeral, and I was working in rehearsal at the time. I was having a difficult argument with another person who was on the creative team, and I was so angry. So I hop into the back of this car, a taxi, with Tom to head to the funeral, and I'm telling Tom this, and I'm in a rage, you know. I'm telling him about the row I had that morning with this bastard, you know, this awful person that I'm working with. And he looked at me and he said, don't lose your balance. Don't lose your balance. And like, it's almost like you have to be in that situation to know what he was talking about. I think a word that Buddhists use is equanimity. Equanimity, which is a real big noble truth of Buddhism, that you can find detachment and you can find equanimity if you work at it. And don't lose your equanimity. The Dalai Lama might say to you, and here was McIntyre, the Calvin man, saying, don't lose your balance. It meant the same thing. And I always try and use that as a way to check myself if I'm going into a situation where I'm going to be engaged socially or work-wise with somebody that I have a disagreement with, you know, that we're viscerally, emotionally not compatible. And I just say to myself, don't lose your balance. I'm not trying to agree with them, and I'm not trying to disagree with them. I'm trying to find a different space. And that's why I've often said in podcasts that I think that the word ahimsa, the idea of ahimsa is non-violence in terms of Indian Buddhism and so forth. It's like ahimsa is creating a space. I see it as like a geographical thing. I really do. You embody your emotions. I'll give you an example. If you're having an argument with somebody, there's a danger that you actually physically tend to get more and more face to face. Now, it could be a small argument with your son or your daughter, your mother or father, your beloved. It could be, but you start to go at them physically if you notice, you know. Not to hit them, but you're physically kind of going towards them. I did not do that, or you did this, or whatever you're arguing about. And it's amazing how physical manoeuvring can create space. For example, I get one example, and this is used by people who do conflict resolution. If you're in that situation and you're kind of targeted on somebody and you're having an argument, if you turn around 360 degrees, like move your body around the room, just take something to your right, like a writing desk, a book is here beside me, and then that'll move me to something else. And let your eye go around the room. There's a shelf of books up here to my right. Let your eye go around the room, right round. So you do a 360-degree turn. You look at the door. Your eye moves. It scans the entire room. You've now created a circle around you. It takes about 20 seconds at most to scan the entire room. The other person will not know what you're doing. But I guarantee you, you will feel less aggressive when your eyes rest on that person after doing the circle. I also guarantee you that there is nothing now that person can say to you that will trigger you to further anger. You can discuss with them for the next hour what your contention is, what the two of you disagree about, but you won't have any anger in the same way. And that's a classic example to me of how your physicality embodies who you are at an imaginal level, at a creative, at a level of Plato's sense of form. And that when you do that sweep, you're doing a ritual that's no different than perhaps 5,000 years ago a shaman might have taken his magic wand and done a circle around his body on the ground to create a protected space. And you're doing no more than the priest does in the Orthodox Church when he moves with the procession around the congregation, in a circle around the edges of the walls, and incenses the various icons in the building. Again, creating a circle. The power of your embodied emotion, the power of your dance, the power of your physical expression is a powerful tool when it comes to arguments, because arguments tend to be in the head all the time. And that, to me, also brings me back to what I talked about at the beginning of this podcast, struggling at this time of year, how to embody what's within, the sense of one's own self within as being contingent, as being not absolute in its own power, but more surrendering constantly to otherness. The sense of that being present, being trapped in time and space, but never being the victim of time and space, never simply being a vessel through which stuff flows. and possesses, being empty in a way that has its own inner form. So that I am empty, myself is not important, and yet being here is an utterly exquisite joy. And being here is like, once I get to that inner sense, I find balance, and I'm not a victim anymore of aggression. And I'm not a victim of my own aggression, and people around me are not a victim of my aggression. If I'm coming from this inner space. But what I was saying at the beginning of this is that I find it more and more difficult to find how to do that. I suppose you might think when you get older it'd be clearer, but no, it's not. It never is. It's always this daily struggle. How am I in the world? Am I too close to the arguments, the passions, the anger, the joy, the fun, the crack, the drink, the other people? Am I just too close? Am I living at the surface too extremely? And getting engaged in all the rows and arguments? Or am I too abstracted? Am I too much within myself? Am I relying on these ideas about Platonic forms so deeply that I kind of float around in my own inner world with angels and I'm callous to the people around me, living a kind of a sad, lonely life? Is the life of a monastic a sad, lonely life? I don't think it is. I think it's the perfect balance. I think you need the two. Solitude and communion with other people. I think you need identity in yourself, which you get from being alone, and you need to be relevant to the world and to other people, so you need to communicate. There's always the balance between the two. And that's why I read that piece about the angel, the absent angel. Because, and I read it on Sunday Miscellany, I don't know if they have broadcast it yet or not, but I'm particularly fond of it, and I'm going to finish off just by reading it again, if you don't mind. Because what I'm trying to express in it is a kind of a subtle thing. It's, I look at the world and I see an ordinary world that I'm engaged in. And I see most of the people around me fully committed to material reality, digital reality, engaged in conversations which are like in your face. Everybody's in everybody else's face, like, and they're boiling rage and they're arguing with each other, and then there's wars, and then they talk about, there's a phrase they use now about the earth is burning. I don't know about that, but I mean, again, I try and see the two sides of that conversation about the environment. But certainly the phrase the earth is burning is quite a dramatic phrase, and not one that you would imagine will help young people find their balance and find their joy. And, you know, it's another conversation I know that I've accidentally slipped into, but just to say, you always have to ask yourself whether naming the problem in an extremely negative way, is that a solution, or could that possibly precipitate people to continue along a road of destruction? You know? I mean, if you were in the back seat of a car, there was a young driver and they were going too fast, and then they get a skid, and as they're skidding, you say from the back seat, we're all fucked now. It mightn't help the driver get his her composure back and come out of the skid and save everybody's life. You know, if you throw up your hands and say, "Owl, we're all finished now. The earth is burning." It's such a dystopian way of looking at it that, from my point of view, I'd always feel maybe that's not really the full truth. Maybe there is a more positive, more beautiful way to think about where we are at this historical moment. You know, maybe that, in a sense, you look at how much poverty has been relieved, how much improvements in technology have happened, how the future could open up in wonderful ways because of artificial intelligence, how much more awake and conscious and civil we are with each other at a certain level in many societies. And how perhaps all that global energy and power of positivity will find ways to manage global warming, to reduce global warming, so that in 50 or 100 years' time our grandchildren will live joyously in a beautiful cosmos. I like to think about that side of it as well. And I don't think I'm being an ostrich by thinking like that. So again, the funny thing is, even with global warming, I'm not what they call climate denier, but I do think about all the different arguments that different people make. And what I do is I try and create within myself this sense of ahimsa, of non-violence, of a kind of a detachment that recognizes the imaginal realm, the platonic ideals or forms, are a beautiful way to look at the world if you can stay balanced between the internal and the external. If you can be balanced between the fact that you have an internal self and then you have a surface of engagement. You have identity and you have relevance. And that finding that balance, finding that space of ahimsa, is always about recognizing the non-existence of an absolute self. It's not all about me. You can let go of me, actually. Even if you're hurt, even if you're, you know, a little micro-oppression or whatever is wounding you emotionally, you can leave it alone for a moment and find a deeper level of your own self in the part that says you are only contingent. You are not the one that the universe revolves around. You're not the most important person in the room. That is such a relaxed way to live. It's such a relief to know, to be able to smile. I smile sometimes, you know. I just turn on a smile. And sometimes it's like automatically, it's like a clock. Because I'm simply inside reminding myself, I'm not important in this room. Now it may look like, oh, I've just walked into the room and people are looking at me. Actually, I'm not, you know. Any other person is twice as important or more important, whatever. Relax. So how to make the balance between the two becomes my daily struggle. Sometimes I talk so much on the podcast about angels and about Jesus, about the resurrection, about the ascension, about Mary, Queen of Heaven. I talk so much in those, you know, imaginal terms that I then worry, am I living some sort of sad, isolated life in my own head and not communicating? Because when I communicate with people at the outside, that's not the kind of way people talk. And that's a struggle for me. But one of the things the podcast has taught me is that struggle is actually beneficial for me to constantly be investigating and not to lose sight, obviously, of the room around me, the people around me, the you who is here with me, that I can embrace, I can look in your eyes, I can feel your presence and know that we live in a sensual world, and we live in a secular world, and we live in a world of just things, and that's good. In fact, it's amazing. That's another podcast, you know, that we're actually here embodied. We are so lucky. So I mustn't lose sight of that. But then I mustn't lose sight in my own life, I think, of Christ, of the inner Christ, and how to keep that alive, and how to maintain oneself on the surface, and yet at the same time maintain oneself as embodying an inner Christ. That's tricky. That is tricky. And this little story was a summation of that. You know, the angel that I began to see, there was a little heater in the corner and there was wind coming out of it. It was the day I went back to work in the coal studio, turned on the blow heater was moving the curtain. I'm looking at the curtain move, and it's just that sense of a moving curtain makes me feel as if somebody had just left the room. And I thought, angel, it's an angel has just left. So the image blended for me. It blended a sense of being on the surface in the real world and also not losing sight of that inner sense of presence. The inner sense of presence, I must do a podcast on this. The inner sense of presence, I think, really grew deeply out of the story of the empty tomb. The empty tomb is such a powerful idea. The idea of the experience of God's presence in the risen Christ is rooted in this physical, sensual world where they went to the tomb and found it empty. You know? So the physical world does actually, if you trust it, it opens the door into the spiritual. The surface will always open the door into the inner depth of meaning. And it's a question of always keeping your eye out in the physical world for those little shimmers of light, those accidental moments which are in fact interventions by the angelic forces. I bought a heater before Christmas to take the chill out of the air in my writing studio. A dainty little fan heater in pearl white plastic. It hummed softly in the corner and I could feel warm air moving around the room. That was the last thing I did before diving into the glittering mirage of jingling bells on Christmas Eve, and I didn't open my studio door again until the festival was finished. My wife woke early on Boxing Day and her first words were, "Thank God it's over." We say that every year, but the fuss and anxiety never changes. It comes and then it goes, and we wake up the morning afterwards with a kind of relief. The in-between days, just after Boxing Day and before the New Year, are empty. Even the sky is painted in watercolours, and I spend hours staring at sad flickering lights in the garden and wonder not just where Christmas has gone, but where my entire life went. Myself and my wife break the shells of our eggs in unison. We enjoy the physical harmony of animals who have spent a lifetime together. "Where does it go?" I ask her sometimes, but she doesn't reply. Instead, she just offers me another slice of toast. Over the years, Christmas rituals have woven our separate lives into a single fabric. We've observed the same tedious rituals year after year. We've shared Christmas turkeys with Granny and other loved ones long gone to eternal rest. We've shared plum puddings with couples who are now divorced. And we pulled dozens of crackers with our children before they grew up and went off to feed their own horses somewhere far away. The cyclic nature of Christmas is reassuring. The repetition of things is comforting. To know that life is a wheel of beginnings and endings, and that we return to the same old beginning each January. Christmas vanishes like smoke from a quenched candle, like snow from a rope, and the empty January sky becomes a refuge as the light stretches ever so delicately towards the shoots of a crocus in the grass beneath the beeches. I sit by the window as the afternoon fills up with sleeping cats, and I sense in the renewal of sunlight that I am forgiven once more and free to begin again. I realise that soon the sun will rise higher and the spring will arrive without my efforts or anxieties. In short, I have nothing to worry about. One Christmas, when I was 10 years old, I worried a lot because I broke the Virgin Mary statue by letting her fall on the mosaic floor of the cathedral, as I was carrying her enormous plaster weight to the crib where she was supposed to hang out for the festival. She skittered along the marble for 3 long metres. Her hands were scratched, and I worried that the priest would wallop me across the same marble floor for being so careless. But no one except me noticed the damaged fingers of the Holy Virgin as she knelt in frozen prayer for the entire 12 days of Christmas, gazing in porcelain equanimity at her equally porcelain baby in the manger. I endured that Christmas season in terror, because back then the crib meant a lot to me, and to desecrate it was like undoing the universe. But then I grew up, and like many more in Ireland, I abandoned the infant and the angels and saw the dead plaster statues for what they really were. We still put up a crib on the mantelpiece, but when people come to call, they rarely notice it, except to wonder why it's there. Nowadays, the season is bloated with realism, opulence, and digestible delights. I must wait until January to find poetry now, because in January the earth turns again, shifting its heft, shifting the heft of its hope towards the sun. And the sky is so empty and watery that almost everything feels possible. When I returned to work, my studio was like an icebox. I was glad I had bought the heater before the holiday to take the chill out of the air, the dainty little fan heater in pearl-white plastic. It hummed softly in the corner, and I could feel warm air moving around the room. I pressed the power button on the computer and waited for the screen to light up, and as the dainty white fan heater in the corner pushed air around the room, I noticed the lace curtains moving, and for no reason in particular, it reminded me of an angel's feather, just after the angel has gone. Thank you for being here. And may you have a happy, peaceful New Year. Bye-bye.